so many familiar faces. Feels like coming home in many ways. I'm especially gratified you came out not knowing what I was going to talk about tonight. I don't think I gave a title, but I'll tell you now. I thought I would address the issue of awareness. I want to try to explore what that word means in our experience. And I want to explore what you might call the shades of awareness. I was going to call this the 50 shades of awareness. But I thought that might be a confusing topic. I'm going to try at least not to mention anything erotic. Awareness is what we are, what we do. It's that sort of knowing that takes place moment by moment in our experience. I use the word awareness as broadly as possible. I use it to be synonymous with words like consciousness, words like knowing. And the exploration of this idea, which is really is at the very heart of our meditation practice. Meditation practice is largely a tool for learning how to explore awareness, how to investigate awareness. I want to use as a way of coming at this term the Pali language. As Doug said, I am trained as a scholar, so I work with these texts in the original often. And I want to try to introduce you to some of the nuances and shading found in the original sources on these teachings about the mind and consciousness and awareness. But I want to try to do it in a way that's not too academic. I don't want to make it a philological discourse on the Pali words for knowing. What I've become accustomed to attempting, at least, is what I call not so much a horizontal scholarship, learning a lot about something, like Buddhist texts or Buddhist ideas, but what I prefer to call a kind of vertical scholarship. Can we use the intellect? Can we use language? Can we use study? And in this case, a close study of the ancient Pali language to help facilitate a deeper understanding of something fairly simple, straightforward, and right in front of us. We're not interested in the kind of study that makes all these connections to all these different things. We're interested in the kind of study that helps us hone in ever more carefully, ever more subtly on some core ideas. In this particular case, this core idea being awareness. Consciousness. What is that? So I'm going to be introducing you to some of the many words that are used in the Buddha's teaching for talking about awareness. As you might not be surprised to hear, the Buddha spoke about this topic often. Matter of fact, the entire Dhamma, the entire teachings that he left behind really is an elaborate investigation of awareness. And so I want to try to use these words, but in a way that will, like I say, help facilitate our understanding rather than obscure or confuse it. So forgive me for lapsing into Pali here and there, but I'm going to use it as a tool. So the word primarily used for this in Pali is this root, J-N-A, gna, nya. That sound, nya, is their word for knowing. And that J-N-A is directly related as an Indo-European language to the Greek G-N-O, gnosis, the Latin cognize, and in English the K is in K-N-O, kno. Our word for know is directly related to these other words in Indo-European languages. And it's really the most basic, most simple, most apparent, most straightforward thing in our lives. We are beings that know. We consist of knowing. Knowing moment after moment after moment. And this word gna is used throughout the Pali teachings, throughout the Buddhist teachings. And it turns out that we know in a lot of different ways. And in fact, one of the things that the Buddha was really master at, and it's one of the things that's really most appealing about this teaching, especially in the meditation texts, is the way in which he's able to discern different shades, different aspects, different nuances in this word to know. And English, I think, is capable of mirroring these nuances that the Buddha points out, but we're going to have to work at it a little bit. I think English is capable of it, but I'm not sure our culture is capable of it. We tend to, in our ordinary use of English, in our ordinary encounter with our own minds, tend to think in some fairly narrow categories, some fairly simplistic ways. And there are depths that are there available for investigation. I think that's really what draws so many of us to this practice. It's really an exploration of the depths of consciousness, as opposed to what clever things we're capable of accomplishing with that consciousness, which of course is what our mainstream culture is primarily concerned with. So this word jña, to know, well, much like other Indo-European languages, like English, the Pali uses a root and then adds various prefixes to it. And these prefixes, when added to a root, give it some direction, some spin, some amplification, if you will, explanation. So what are some of the prefixes that are put to this word jña to give the different meanings? So if jña simply means to know, one prefix is vi, which is meaning of separation or discernment, distinguishing. And so vijna gives us the word vijnana, which is their word for consciousness. So knowing, jña, is the basic idea. Vijnana is a discriminating knowing, a discerning knowing. Consciousness is able to distinguish the differences between this moment and the next moment, between this object and the next object. Consciousness is always taking an object, and it's the knowing of that object, knowing that discerns or discriminates a unique, particular moment of knowing. So vijnana, the word for consciousness, takes this notion of jña, knowing, and specifies it to a particular time and place, a particular instance of knowing, a particular episode of knowing. Now, one thing to keep in mind throughout this exploration is that, in Buddhism, the mind is really more of a verb than it is a noun. It's an event that occurs. It's a process that happens. It's not a thing. There's no such thing called the mind, except using that expression fairly metaphorically. The mind is a series of events where the knowing of an object takes place, and then the knowing of another and another. So it's a process of knowing. Another prefix that's often used is sum, S-A-M. And this is kind of like English con, and it has the sense of assembling or consolidating or bringing together, like a convergence or a confluence. Sum in Pali and Sanskrit, like a sangha, a group of people coming together. When sum is added to jña, samjña, we get the word sanya, which means perception. That is, it's the kind of knowing that tells us about concepts and interpretation, understanding an object to be something, a table, a chair, a plant, anything. And this idea of assembly is it takes all kinds of detailed inputs from our senses and sort of assembles them into ideas, into words, into core concepts. And then these are constructions, these constructed ideas, we then use to fuel our organize our thoughts and our narratives and our stories and so forth. So this is a different kind of knowing. We've seen there's three kinds of knowing now. There's just knowing. Then there's a discriminating knowing, which is kind of focus in on something very precisely. And then there's a symbol of knowing, a knowing that kind of conglomerates things together into a set of grosser ideas and symbols and words that we can then manipulate into our trains of thought and into our narratives and so forth. So that's sannyā. There are many, many others. We're not going to go through all of them. One of the prefixes used, abhi, generally means towards something and mastering something, facing something and learning to master it. So abhinyā, when that's brought to this word nyā, you have the sense of abhinyas. You've heard of the six abhinyas, perhaps. These are translated as kind of higher knowledges or special powers. It's a kind of knowing that is a certain mastery. It's a mastery of certain techniques, a mastery of certain skills. Among the abhinyas, there are six of them. Among them are things like remembering one's past lives or being able to read another person's mind. These are special knowledges, sometimes special ways of knowing. That's one of the ways that that word is translated. Abhinyā, so knowing, but a knowing that is kind of mastered, special perfection of knowing almost. Then there are more minor examples. Pari is a word like in our perimeter, which means all around. So parinyā is a complete knowing, a thorough knowing, a knowing all about something, a sort of all-encompassing knowing. Or anu is a prefix meaning along with, going along with. So anunya is a kind of anujanami, is kind of knowing in accordance with. It means approval when two people agree with one another. You know, then their knowing is in harmony with one another. So things like that. Now, when the word nya itself is defined, when the commentators of the, or actually it's in the suttas, it's not the commentaries, when the Buddha tries to describe what does he mean by knowing, there are a list of words that are used that give us some sense of what he means by this basic knowing. So some of the words that he uses often as synonyms of knowing are words for seeing. Seeing is a kind of knowing. In fact, knowing and seeing are often said in tandem as a pair, almost as synonyms. Knowing is a way of seeing, and seeing is a way of knowing. The sense of direct perception of something being in front of the eyes, of something immediately tangible. So that's a kind of knowing. He defines nya or knowing in terms of things like to get something, adigacchati, to sort of arrive at, a knowing that arrives at some object or arrives at some truth or arrives at some experience, gets to, in touch with something, if you will. Another word used is a kind of a finding, a discovering. Knowing is a kind of discovering something about the world, discovering something about ourselves, learning something about ourselves or the world. He uses words like a kind of something gained or attained or received, almost like knowing is a kind of gift that we receive. There's information in the world that's being generated by photons and sound waves and molecules and so forth. And there's a sense in that in the knowing of that, we are receiving some sort of information from the world and then participating in an active act of knowing in some ways. So, you know, those are just some of the linguistic landscape, if you will, of how they're, you know, this word is malleable and is used in different ways in different contexts. What we're most interested in is the fundamentally different ways in which this word to know is manifesting in our experience, the experience that we can notice here and now when we pay attention in meditation practice. And so a simple sort of map of the inner landscape around these nuances of the word knowing starts with a knowing that is embodied. And a knowing, it's a mental act. It's an act of sort of mental cognition, as we would say. But it's always embodied. It's not abstract. It's something that is done by a person who has a body or consists in part of a body. And it's not only, you know, the brain and all those neural mechanisms, which are clearly needed for these acts of cognition on some level, but also the fact that our knowing things is rooted in what they call this fathom-long body, this whole body. It's not just something in our head. It's deeply permeating our physicality. And that is to say, one of the ways that we know is by knowing a bodily sensation. It's an embodied knowing. When, you know, I touch myself on the arm or the room is too hot or too cold, that's something that I know. It's a knowing about physicality, about the body, about the material world. It's a direct knowing through the body. And in fact, the same is happening with the other senses. One of the ways that we touch the world or encounter and come in contact with the world is through the body, but also through the sense of smell and of taste. These are three ways of touching the world: smell, taste, and physical sensations of the body. This is direct knowing. This is a knowing that is rooted in these organs of knowing. I mean, what these organs do is they provide a platform or basis, a support for moments of knowing. Without that platform, we wouldn't be able to know anything because we wouldn't have the apparatus. So the body, if you will, is an apparatus or a mechanism of knowing. And much of what we know viscerally. We know directly in the body. It's not a thought. It's not an idea. It's not a word. It's not a concept. Knowing, in its most primal sense, is just feeling something in the body. And of course, this is what the first foundation of mindfulness is all about. They're asking us to know, to be aware, to experience directly what it feels like to have a body, to have sensations arising and passing away in the body. And of course, the last two senses, you know, the eye and the ear, sight and sound, those are also embodied ways of knowing. When we hear a sound, it's a kind of knowing. Knowing is, therefore, in order for knowing to occur, it has to emerge from and be dependent upon one of the six organs that we have in our body: the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind, or the brain is the sixth. Those are the tools, if you will, that do the knowing, or that are used for the knowing, without which knowing could not occur, because that knowing, that consciousness, that awareness, is some aspect of the physical organs. The other thing, of course, that embodies it is that each of these physical organs is adapted to a particular kind of information. In other words, what we know, the content of what we know, the knowing, is the objects of awareness. We know sights, we know sounds, we know smells, tastes, we know physical sensations. It's the knowing of thoughts and memories and ideas. So knowing is always embodied in a sense organ, and it always includes some content that is known. Knowing could not occur without there being something known. Almost by definition, knowing is knowing something. In other traditions, in later Buddhism, they have this notion of pure awareness or pure consciousness, but that wasn't on the table in ancient India when the Buddha was writing. That was a later idea. He always talked about knowing as being fundamentally embodied, and it's really a kind of contact that occurs between the capacity to know, the mechanism for knowing, and the data or information that's known. These three things, consciousness, organ, and object, all come together in a moment of awareness. Without those three, you don't have any awareness, and awareness always consists of those three. So one way that we can explore this in our meditation and direct experience is to just sit there and know what it feels like to hear a sound, or to feel a physical sensation, or to have a thought arise and pass away in the mind. These are moments of knowing, a very direct, a very simple, a very unelaborated knowing. So that's knowing as nya, to know, nya. Now, there's another whole different flavor of knowing, a whole different shade of knowing that's also available every single moment, and it requires a slight shift of gear. It's a different kind of knowing. One of the other roots in Pali that's used to mean know is the root vid, V-I-D. And we get things like, vidya, which is knowledge, and avidya, which is ignorance. Vid also comes in a form spelled with an E, ved, V-E-D. We get words like Veda, which is a kind of knowledge, the ancient knowledge texts of Hinduism, and Ayurveda, the wisdom of life, is a medicine of ancient India, for example. So ved means to know. Now, in Pali, ved is the root of the word they use for feeling tone. Vedana is a feeling tone. Now, I add the word tone. I don't just say feeling. I say feeling tone because on its own in English, feeling often means the emotions. We're not talking about emotions. We'll get to those later. We're talking simply about something, once again, that's very embodied. It's very primitive. It goes all the way back to the brainstem. You know, the moment consciousness is generated, awareness occurs, it is awareness that's deeply rooted in a kind of monitoring of the physical sensations that are arising and passing in the body all the time. These sensations are sensations of pleasure, sensations of pain, and in between there's something that's not pleasant or not painful, but it's still a sensation. So these sensations is a kind of knowing that's even more direct and embodied, or similarly direct and embodied as the other. It's the knowing of sensations or feeling tones that either feel good or feel bad. In other words, every moment of knowing also includes a kind of value, if you will, or kind of valence, a kind of quality. In this moment of knowing, what is the quality of that knowing? Not as some conceptual idea, but as a very direct lived experience. What is the intuition of feeling a knowing that's deeply rooted in what's good or bad? What does it feel good? Does it not feel good? And, every sensation that comes up from the body is going to come along with a valence. This sensation in the knee actually hurts, and this sensation in the shoulders feels very pleasant, and this sound that's hitting the ears and coming in contact with the ears, when I know that sound, it's harsh, and so it doesn't feel good. And another sound is very melodic, the bell, I love this gong, it feels good. So we're invited in the meditation text to shift from the first foundation to the second foundation of mindfulness or establishment of mindfulness to explore what that feels like, to explore the quality of the knowing in experience. The knowing is going to be rooted in one of the senses, and it's going to have information delivered by those senses. That's one form of knowing. But then also, that knowing is going to come with a sense of feeling good or feeling bad, feeling pleasant or not feeling pleasant. And the whole second foundation of mindfulness is simply says, when one feels a pleasant sensation, one is aware of feeling a pleasant sensation. When one feels an unpleasant sensation, one is aware of feeling an unpleasant sensation. We're simply being asked to be aware. But instead of a nya awareness, this is a ved awareness. That is, awareness using a different verbal root to express a different quality, a different nuance. What is the difference between knowing the information on the one hand, and knowing the quality of the knowing of that information. It's not the quality of the information, it's the quality of the experience of knowing that information, if you follow me. So that's a whole different way of looking at things. And in fact, in the, well, I'll talk about that later. So then there's a third way. There's a whole nother realm of knowing happening every single moment, accessible to everyone all the time, which is unlike those other two. And here we use that samnya to sort of build up a knowing that is conceptual, the aggregate of a perception. That is, there is part of our mind, part of our brain, whose job it is to make sense of the object that we're knowing, to put some label on it, to interpret it, to put some meaning, to elaborate, to build a narrative, to tell a story. This is the part of the mind that we're all most familiar with, I would argue. This is the part of the mind that's thinking, conceptualizing, putting into language, chattering to ourselves, communicating to one another. This is the part when we're not just sitting there breathing, but we're saying, you know, I wonder if I'm breathing right. Or, you know, I breathe in and now I'm breathing out, but, you know, what am I going to do tomorrow or whatever. The perception or the interpretive, the cognition, the cognitive content of experience is a whole nother sense of the word knowing. We know an object as whatever, the sound of a bird, the feeling of a pain in the knee, the, you know, that's a table, that's a chair, that's a tree, that's the sky. That we are constantly putting labels on what we know. That labeling of moments of knowing, that's the conceptual piece. That's the part that's samnya, that's a knowing that's assembled. That's not the same. Knowing about something, or knowing the name of something, or knowing something that's being used as an element in a story that you're telling yourself, or a phrase that you're repeating to yourself, or a piece of music, or something that's been shaped by content. The content has been shaped by language, by imagery, by culture, by, you know, personal history. In other words, this is the knowing that is actually constructing meaning of moment to moment of what it is that we're actually experiencing. So that's a whole third kind of way of using the mind. And, you know, that construction of meaning happens at, you know, different levels of scale. On the sensory level, that interpretive filter of every moment is the knowing what it is that we're hearing, what it is that we're feeling, what it is that we're seeing. And it happens instantaneously. It happens automatically. The minute an object appears to one of the senses, we not only know it, but we know it as something. We label it. Whether we formally label it with our words and our language or not, we're still at a very subliminal level, carving that sensory input into a meaningful object, which is then something that we can cognize. And this cognition is this third sense of knowing. It's a knowing about. If the first is a sort of direct knowing of, and the second is a knowing the quality of, this third is knowing about something. Sanjanati, to know about something, to perceive, to interpret, to construct a meaning. Those are three, you know, different senses of knowing that are said to co-arise. They're three of the five aggregates. They're actually four of the five aggregates if we include the sense object, organs and objects. And so in one passage, the Buddha says, you know, it's hard to discern the difference between those three. Those are not three different lobes of the brain, although I'm guessing, you know, specific parts of the brain contribute to specific aspects of that. These are three nuances to the same event. What's happening is simply knowing, but we're knowing in three slightly different ways, or simultaneously distinct ways. And we can shift our attention in meditation practice to observing one or the other of these shades of meaning of awareness, these shades of awareness. And so whether it's nya with the knowing at the heart of the word consciousness, or samnya, the assembled knowledge at the heart of the word interpretive cognition, or ved, the knowing that is intuitive and direct, embodied, those are all three uses of the word to know in three different linguistic constructions. And as we know from the basic meditation practice, we can notice the shift from one to the other very easily. When, for example, we're trying to be aware of the bodily sensations, and we find that we start thinking about those bodily sensations. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but sometimes conceptual thinking intrudes upon your uninterrupted mindfulness of the body. And when that happens, you can feel the shift. Usually not until you notice it, but when you do notice it, it becomes apparent. I was simply knowing the texture of the sensation, and suddenly I'm knowing some story that I'm telling myself, or some memory, or some association. That's a totally different way of using the mind. But I'm meditating now, so I'm going to let go of that for now and come back to re-engage with this other kind of knowing, this more immediate knowing. And maybe if I'm working with pleasure and pain, shift to the qualitative assessment of the knowing. So those three are happening simultaneously, and we can shift our attention from one to the other, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes it shifts involuntarily. Now there's another way, a whole other way, of understanding this word know. And here we have to introduce yet another root, another verb, another verbal root. And this one in Pali is chit. Chit or chint means to think. But chit also is used for the word chitta, which is one of the words for the mind. Mind. Another spelling of this word chitta for mind is cheta, C-E-T-A, or C-E-T-O. In Pali, a C is always pronounced the C-H, so ch. C-E-T-A, cheta. Cheta is a word for mind. It's yet another word for to know. But this cheta has a sense of a sort of causative construction and grammatically, which is it's a stronger verb. It's a verb that causes something to happen or causes something to be. And so from that we get this Pali word chetana, which really means volition or intention. It is the mind that is responding. The knowing that it is engaged in is a knowing that's in action. A knowing of a response, a knowing with a certain attitude, a certain emotion, a certain intentional stance or volitional impulse. In other words, our knowing, these first three are fairly passive. We're trying to figure out what's going on in the world. But this one is more active. It's a knowing that engages, that positions oneself. I'm hearing this sound and it feels good and it's the bird. How am I engaged with that? How is my knowing going into action in relation to that sound? And this is where we get the range of emotions, especially the primary ones in Buddhist thought, at least, of wanting and not wanting, liking and not liking. We don't just hear the sound. It also has a feeling tone. It also has an interpretive cognitive element, and it's got this emotional response, this emotional engagement. We are participating in that moment of cognizing the object, and that participation is represented by the knowing that is active, that is in relation to. It's almost as if, you know, these various qualities which make up our different emotional capacities, these qualities sort of hold consciousness with a certain attitude, a certain quality of engagement. And so this is another thing that can be explored. This is where the third foundation of mindfulness goes. The third foundation of mindfulness, many of you know, is called mindfulness of mind. You would think it means simply be mindful of the mind, of consciousness, but it actually doesn't. When you look at the text, it means awareness of how the mind is influenced by the primary emotions, how the mind is influenced by wanting, how the mind and liking, how the mind is influenced by not wanting and not liking, and how the mind can be clear or confused, how it can be influenced by, delusion or not. So the way it's put in the text is simply, when the mind is impacted or influenced by sense desire in some ways, or some form of wanting, one notices that the mind is influenced by wanting. And when the mind is not influenced by wanting, one notices that the mind is not influenced by wanting. And then the same thing is said for not wanting and for, you know, clarity and delusion. So we're actually observing how the mere knowing, the bare knowing, the knowing that is at the heart of it all, the consciousness, is affected, is influenced, is shaped, is steered, is directed by this intention or this directional knowing, either towards something that we want or like, or away from something that we don't want or don't like. And I promised to say something about kindness, so kindness fits into this. When, in a moment of knowing, you can directly feel the emotional tone of caring for that object of your awareness, of being benevolent towards it, of being kind and friendly towards that object. Doesn't matter what the object is. It's the attitude of mind with which you are attending to it. That's the third foundation of mindfulness. You're being aware that the mind is influenced by loving kindness. And then a moment later, that could be gone. Notice that that loving kindness is gone. You know? And so this is like a fourth, if you will, quality of knowing, this word to nya. So to recapitulate, we have this sort of image of the mind. Here you are practicing, sort of hovering in the center. You can be aware simply of what it feels like to be aware, aware of being aware, aware of awareness. Or you can tilt towards one side, towards the valence of it. Does it feel good or bad? Or tilt in another direction toward the content of it. What's the story here? What's the word? What's the construction of meaning going on? Or you can tilt towards the emotional response. Is this a moment of knowing that I feel this way or that way about? Feel now in the emotional sense of the word, that I experience an engagement with of one quality or another. And those are four very different experiences. They're all tied together. I mean, it's all just awareness. But the Buddha in his meditation instructions, and Pali in its creative use of these roots and these prefixes, has given us a sort of an outline, a map of the territory of experience, of experience that is immediately accessible to you. And he uses this language and variations of it throughout the key instructions for meditation. So, for example, the Insight Meditation text begins simply by saying, you know, a person goes to the root of a tree or to an empty place and sits down, crosses their legs, puts their back straight, and establishes mindfulness in front of one. Then it says, mindfully one breathes in and out. And then it starts using this word for janat, for jhan, for to know, nya. It says, a person breathes in and out. When a person breathes in, he is aware, she is aware that she's breathing in. When a person breathes out, he or she is aware that they're breathing out. And that word they use for awareness is pajanati. Now, nya is the root, janati is the basic verb, to know, And pa-janati is adding one of these prefixes. This pa is a prefix which suggests the direction of forward motion, of moving towards something, of moving, approaching something, of moving towards a goal or towards an object. So there's two ways of understanding this word pajanati, that is to be aware. This Satipatthana text, this text with the meditation instruction, takes up about 8 pages in a Pali edition. And on those 8 pages, I counted once, and I'm not sure I've got the number right, but something like that word to be aware is used something like 138 times on 8 pages. It's basically an exploration of the field of experience, and at each point he says, one is aware of that, and one is aware of that, and one is aware of that. And what it is that one is aware of shifts from, you know, body sensations to the feeling tones, to the different emotional tones, to the objects of awareness in the fourth foundation. And it simply says, one is aware of this, one is aware of that. So it's an exploration of the textures of awareness that are available to us at all time. And then, for example, when it talks to breathe in and out, experiencing the whole body, this word they use for experiencing shifts to the meaning ved, pati ved, vedetis, to feel. That one feels the entire body. Pati samvedi. Pati is sort of back to, sam is including, and veda is this qualitative knowing that comes from the root vid. So they're asking us, once we are aware of the breath, then we turn that awareness and we turn it into a kind of direct feeling, this kind of embodied, intuitive knowing of what it feels like, what it's to experience the entire in-breath and the entire out-breath. It's directing our attention to this direct feeling tone. And then we become aware of that. A little bit later in the chorus, it talks about, you know, a person abiding, observing the mind and body, observing the processes in the body and so forth. And there the word is anupassati. Passati is the verb to see. One sees. Anu is that prefix meaning along with. So seeing along with what is arising and vanishing in the body. Now the metaphor of knowing is shifted to one of seeing, observing. And it's almost like, you know, you watch a bee fly in the window and track it across the room and it flies out the other window. So bodily sensations will arise and experience. Observe it. Watch, see along with it. That's the quality of knowing in that moment. Seeing along with what's happening. That's what you know in that moment. And then it vanishes. The next thing comes up. Maybe it's a sound. Maybe it's a physical sensation. Maybe it's a thought. Instead of getting lost in the content of the thought, though, you see the thought enter and pass away. You see along with what is already happening. That's why we're not interfering. We're not trying to change it. We're simply regarding it. We're observing it. And then other words are used in that text. Later on, when they talk about seeing the body in terms of the 32 body parts, many of which are internal and we have to use a kind of conceptual knowledge to access, or when it talks about observing the body in terms of the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, that also is a kind of conceptual knowledge. There the verb changes. Then it's pachavekati. That is, pacha is against, and veka is a kind of vision, a kind of the eye. It's kind of reflecting upon. When we reflect upon the body as composed of elements or as composed of parts that we can't directly see, now we're shifting our knowing to this kind of immediately embodied direct knowing that we've been talking about so far, to a kind of observation. Now we're looking on, we're gazing upon what's happening. And that's the same verb used when they talk about the reflection in a mirror. Now, that famous text when the Buddha asks his son Rahula, what's a mirror for? And he says the mirror is for observing, for reflecting, to reflect back. So there's a whole nother way of using the mind, which is a kind of reflecting upon something. And that's what we're most used to. Now we're using thoughts and words and ideas and conceptual thoughts. It's not what are you directly knowing, but what are you thinking about? What are you observing? What are you regarding? What are you investigating in this more conceptual way? And so that's a different way of using the word. So I don't want to talk all night, and I want to give some time for questions and observations and reflections. So let me just try to sum up what I'm trying to say here, which is simply that at the heart of it, our experience consists of moments of awareness. And this awareness is actually quite diverse. There's a lot of different kinds of awareness accessible to us at one time. And when we get locked into a fairly shallow way of engaging with the world, where everything is, we're using our mind to problem solve and to communicate in language and images and so forth, when we're constantly talking to one another and to ourselves and reading and analyzing and, you know, problem solving in any number of ways, that's effective. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But I think what the Buddha as a teacher and what meditation as a practice is inviting us to do is explore these, it's a metaphor, but these somewhat deeper, somewhat more nuanced, somewhat more subtle modes of the mind. The mind is capable of far more than merely performing tasks. And when we take some time out of our day or out of our year to put ourselves in a situation where we simplify the content of our experience and we are able to focus more fully upon the process of awareness itself in these different aspects, it becomes a very rich territory for investigation. And there's much to be gained by doing so. So I'll stop there and give a chance for questions and comments. Thank you for your attention. I actually did some research the other night with the dictionary and laid out all these different words and roots and everything. And just as a lark at the end, I counted them all up, and there were indeed 50 of them. So maybe I should have kept that title after all, 50 Shades of Awareness. Any thoughts or questions? Yes. No, it's actually the other way around. The concept of pure awareness was there in Hinduism. The Buddha, the historical Buddha, didn't agree with it.
He didn't agree with it?
No, no. He said that consciousness or awareness, by definition, means awareness of something, awareness of an object. Okay. And that consciousness is rather something that arises from the interaction of sense objects and sense organs, rather than something that exists independently and decides to alight on an object. So it's, again, I'm talking about early Buddhism. In later Buddhism, they incorporate more of those Hindu ideas and it becomes, you know, pure awareness becomes an important teaching in later thought. But my understanding, which not to be taken necessarily as the truth, is that there's a lot of language in the early texts that really talk about the conditioned nature of consciousness and how it's always taking an object as one of those conditions.
Okay, and then at the beginning of your talk, you also talked about how things like precognition could happen, or like, what did you say? You used two examples. You were like, awareness of past lives, or extrasensory perception almost. And in when you study like Hindu texts, they do talk about siddhis, which come with like a more advanced consciousness. And I think
yes.
you also touched upon that when you talked about unshackling the mind from a conditioned way of working and taking it into pure consciousness or like higher forms of consciousness. Could you talk about that? That's really fascinating.
Yeah, again, this notion of gaining special mental powers or mental abilities through one-pointed concentrated meditation was an idea that was ancient in Indian tradition and predated the Buddha. So one can go into yogic meditative states and attain special powers. And the Buddha himself did that, and he said other people could do that if they want. He didn't really encourage it. You know, it was considered not particularly efficacious. I mean, it was kind of a distraction. But he was really trying to turn the power of the mind not into doing extraordinary things, but the extraordinary thing he wanted it to do was purify itself of its misconceptions and see things more clearly.
So don't you think in the purification process, those things naturally happen once you like really, truly purify yourself? Like you will be able to tap into heightened forms of perception?
Only with heightened concentration practices. Yeah, and again, that was part of the yogic tradition. They are related, yes. Well, I think the Buddha's innovation was taking things in a different direction. He was moving away from those higher powers and really encouraging people to a sort of insight into the nature of everyday experience that was liberative. And by analogy, another of the words that he used nya for, punya, prajna, is the word for wisdom. So pa is that prefix of moving forward. Wisdom is a kind of knowing that is more significant, more beneficial than mere knowing of objects. Yes?
Hi, good to see you again.
Same.
You ended by saying something about these explorations, the various types of knowing that you said are available, is worthwhile. I think you meant that in a practical way, but I wonder if you could say something about how it could be worthwhile in application to daily life.
Yeah, well, self-knowledge and self-understanding is valuable because it helps us learn from our experience, engage with our experience, and transform our experience. So one of the things that is gained...
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.